is in the hands of God. A similar hadith has been related from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam regarding the same topic, and in a very similar tradition. At the same time, nevertheless, there are certain riwayat, certain traditions, which kind of allude to the fact that surgery specifically was something that was not approved of as a first choice by the Prophet in the Ahlul Bayt in general. Regarding this, a very specific tradition has been related from the Holy Prophet, right? This tradition states that the Prophet was aware of surgery, but he disapproved of it, and he didn't, want, his followers to take resort to this form of the remedy of ailments. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at surgery as a means, as a legitimate means of the remedy of ailments. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on RIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
In my first year of the Hawza, when I had this first class on Ilm al-Kalam, on theology, we had about 3 or 4 years of this course. My teacher had gone through on the board what's called the chain of thoughts. And he went through a six-link chain with me that I want to go through with all of you tonight very quickly. It's usually I take two classes when I teach a course on the subject. I take about two classes to really explain this chain. I don't have that kind of time. Time flies. I'm amongst the beloved. He says, initially now, the first link of the six-link chain of thought is that we have a thought in our head. Thousands of thought enter our mind. Thousands of thought a day, subconscious, consciously, doesn't matter. If ever we stop to think how much activity our brain goes through, we'd be in wonders. Even while we're sleeping, our brain is going. Some experts of neurology say that 95% of our daily life is done subconsciously. That's scary. I remember when I used to work overnight shift from 10 p.m. to 8 a.m. I love that shift so much. It's nice. No dress code, no management. You and three people. After 3 a.m., there's no work. You're paid full. MashaAllah. Pizza place open till 3 o'clock in the morning. It's beautiful. But that drive home at 8 a.m. after a 10-hour shift is a tough one. And literally, I remember some mornings, I would start my car at my job, end up on my driveway, and I have no idea what happened in between. When I actually became conscious, I wasn't passed out, but when I became conscious, I was on my driveway. I'm like, how'd I get here? I was able to south, make a right, make a left, this and that. Literally, the brain shuts off and muscle memory now takes over. 95%, some doctors say. Now, we have control of what happens inside of our subconscious. So my teacher said the first thing that happens is that a thought appears in our head. Could be a random thought, could be a conscious thought. I wonder where he's been this whole time. I wonder about this. I wonder about that. I wonder about the people right now in Karbala. I wonder about what's happening right now in Afghanistan. I wonder about all these things. Tomorrow, for example, what do I want for breakfast? What's my schedule for the day of Ashura? Where am I going on Shabbat Ashur? Thoughts enter, thoughts leave. What am I doing after Muharram and Safar? When will I go back to Hajj? Will Hajj ever happen? Again, it will, inshallah, hopefully. And thoughts enter and thoughts leave. He says there are some thoughts that we are inclined towards that linger in our head. And that's the second link. So from thoughts, he says, to inclination. From fikr to mail. Mail meaning we have this desire toward it. It won't leave our mind. So initially now somebody talks about, for example, the Hajj experience. And you think, wow, you know what? I've never really thought, you know, should I go for Hajj? It's possible, blah, 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 this and that. The talk is over. The guy has left your presence. Weeks pass by. You're still thinking about Hajj, 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 Hajj. Then you think about dates and you think about this. Can I get time off? Blah, blah, blah. How much is it? What's the best group? Blah, blah, blah. So while that initial thought is gone, the thought remains inside of you. Okay? Now there are some thoughts that enter our mind and leave our mind. Now if I can continue this Hajj example, the third link is that it is in my mind so much I'm inclined to the point where I sign up for Hajj. So I go from fikr to mail to fi'il. Follow the chain. So the first three of six links now. A thought, inclination, then action. That action doesn't happen until I'm inclined to it. Now I start asking around. You call me, say, you went for Hajj. Yes, I did. How was it? Would you recommend that group, this group, blah, blah, blah? Yes. Then he starts going online, filling out forms. He actually now begins to convert what was once a thought into actual action. He's moving towards signing up for Hajj. Talks to his boss, 3 weeks off, arranges for the kids to be babysat. Him and his wife now, let's go for Hajj. Perfect. Now action happens. Okay? The fourth link now is khulq. Where now that action now repeats itself over and over and over again. It becomes part of your habits. Khulq, by the way, is where akhlaq comes from, right? Someone's akhlaq doesn't just appear like that. There's work done on someone's akhlaq. That's why from when you're a child, you're taught by your mom or dad, hopefully, about these small, little, basic, little akhlaqi points, right? Oh, my mom would always tell, whenever I entered a room, jaw salam bolo, tum se bade hain, jao salam bolo, ko se salam, and she still does it. I go, mom, come on, man, I'm a father of three. And then, you know, she starts to talk English. I don't care if you're father of three. Go say salam to him. And now to the point where it's a habit of mine. It's part of my akhlaq. I'm not talking about my akhlaq, but I'm saying it happens after constant repetition. So what's built into the fi'il is takrar, repetition, repetition, repetition. It happens enough to the point where it becomes part of your behavior, part of your akhlaq, part of your ethics. That's the fourth link. The fifth link is malaka, which is known as disposition. So follow the link, guys. I hope I'm not losing all of you, right? Fikr, mi'il, fi'il, khulq, malaka. All from one thought. A thought, inclination, action, habit, disposition. Now, you've done it so many times, you do it without thinking. Disposition is when it's so ingrained inside of you, you don't even have to think twice about it. And the final one, really where I want to really bring the point home, the sixth link is thought, is your essence, is the I talked about yesterday. Meaning what? It becomes so part of your akhlaq and behavior, you repeat it so many times that you end up now doing it without thinking about it to the point where you're known as that act. Oh. And by the way, this link, this chain can apply to good habits and also bad habits. You go from gambling a few times to becoming a gambler. Now you're known as a gambler. It's reached your essence level. Now you are a gambler, no longer gamble anymore. You go from smoking to becoming a smoker, drinking to becoming an alcoholic. You go from praying to becoming an abd of Allah. Do you see that link there? Fikr, ma'il, fi'il, khulq, malaka, dhat. Six links to a chain. Meaning it's possible the power of one thought could actually dictate to you who you become. Allahu Akbar. That's scary. Now the ulama have said that from the first link to about the fourth link, from fikr to khulq, from thought to behavior, takes about 40 days, that magical 40 number. 40 days. You do something over and over and over again, it becomes ingrained inside of you. Keep in mind that hadith I presented to you in the beginning. It went from qasadani to what? To rahmati. From the thought of me to my mercy. This goes from a point of fikr all the way to your thought. Thought meaning your essence. We're no longer talking about your physical being, how tall you are, right? The color of your eyes, forget all that. Now it's who you are. The I from yesterday. These are carefully selected and put together lectures. They're all linked together. Now what do we do about this now? His entire purpose behind telling us this class was that when you talk about deen or religion in general, be it Islam or Judaism or Christianity, the deen doesn't come in this chain. The deen is found before the chain. Meaning what? Thoughts don't just appear in our head. This is where I really want your attention. Especially my young guys. I see you in the gym. It's not just appearing inside of you. There are triggers of thoughts. Things that trigger our thoughts. People that trigger our thought. People that place words in our heads. The media, for example. Our circle of influence, for example. The religion, the Ahlul Bayt, the Quran. Ourselves, our tragedy, our triumph. Our family, the environment, social media. All of these are what? Triggers of thoughts. And so while sometimes you can't control what's in your thoughts, you can control your triggers. Not all of them.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahim, Kareem, Azim.
In the limelight.
The United States is the only large wealthy country in the world that doesn't have universal health care. The U.S. healthcare system ranks last among high-income countries. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details on this issue. Stay tuned, please. The website of Common Dreams wrote, "A new report reveals how a lack of health coverage, under insurance, and unaffordable medical bills still plague millions of Americans, despite healthcare reforms in recent years, and makes the latest case for improving and expanding the Medicare system to everyone in the U.S., according to progressives. The Commonwealth Fund conducted a survey between March and July and found that, due to high premiums, deductibles, and copays, 46% of U.S. adults have delayed or altogether avoided receiving health care in the last year. Up to a quarter of people with the chronic health problems were among those who had skipped getting the health care they need, with respondents saying out-of-pocket costs for prescription drugs, for example, life-saving insulin for diabetes, had forced them to skip doses or not fill a prescription. 42% of respondents have struggled to pay medical bills, and 43% were found to be inadequately insured, despite the often cited statistic that the 2010 passage of the Affordable Care Act, ACA, helped 20 million Americans gain coverage. Nearly a quarter of adults in the country are underinsured, with health insurance that fails to provide them with affordable health care, charging them high monthly premiums for coverage, covering medical care only after high deductibles have been fulfilled, or leaving certain kinds of health care out of coverage. Those who were underinsured included 29% of people who had employer-sponsored healthcare plans and 44% of people who purchased coverage individually or through the healthcare marketplace set up by ACA. The average insurance deductible for employer health plans with single coverage is more than $1,000 and is more than $2,000 for healthcare.gov marketplace plans, reads the report, adding out-of-pocket maximums average $4,272 for single coverage in employer plans and range up to $8,700 in marketplace plans. These plan features leave people with considerable cost exposure in case of a sudden illness or accident. 9% of people surveyed were completely without health insurance. The statistics revealed in the survey amount to a disgrace in the American healthcare system, said the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS. This is shameful, said the group, adding, no one should have to go into debt because they need to access healthcare. No one should have to choose between seeing a doctor and paying bills. Half of the people surveyed said they would be unable to pay an unexpected $1,000 medical bill within 30 days, including 69% of black adults and 63% of Latinos. The Commonwealth Fund prominently pointed out that Americans have record high health coverage, but Representative Pramila Jayapal, the author of the Medicare for All Act, which has 121 co-sponsors in the U.S. House, pointed out that 26 million Americans are still lacking health insurance. She said, let's pass Medicare for All and guarantee health care as a right to all. Also, the website of Truth Out wrote, racial inequities in the U.S. are emerging in the vaccination and treatment of monkeypox, just as they saw with COVID. In recent weeks, roughly 25% of new monkeypox cases have occurred among white patients, yet more than 33% of monkeypox vaccines have gone to white patients as of September 27th. Financial and logistical barriers to monkeypox care can disproportionately affect patients of color. In New York City, appointments for monkeypox treatment and vaccination distributed on a first-come, first-served basis have disproportionately gone to wealthy white individuals who have better access to healthcare system. The first vaccines were doled out in Chelsea, a mostly white neighborhood, during the middle of the work days. Even when vaccines began to be distributed in Harlem, a neighborhood that is 82% non-white, appointments appear to go largely to white residents from outside the community, leaving community members frustrated. Such disparities mirror larger trends in the U.S. society. Across specialties, physicians disproportionately spend their time seeing white patients, despite patients of color, on average, having higher medical needs. Due to the legacy of slavery, indigenous genocide, xenophobic immigration regulations, and centuries of racist economic policies, patients of color in the U.S. are more likely to be under or uninsured, and in general, have lower incomes. Patients of color are also more likely to experience difficulties accessing transportation or taking paid time off work to access appointments. The latter is particularly important for individuals with monkeypox, which requires prolonged isolation and whose painful lesions can inhibit the ability to work. Americans need explicitly anti-racist policies to repair these harms. Medicare for All would eliminate financial barriers to healthcare and, in doing so, help address the racial inequities highlighted by the monkeypox pandemic. Medicare for All would establish a single-payer system in which all U.S. residents would receive health insurance. All U.S. residents would have access to medications, doctor appointments, and hospitalizations with low or no copayments. Undocumented individuals could be covered under the current House bill as to be determined by U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services. Studies show that Medicare for All would have saved 340,000 lives so far during the COVID pandemic, primarily by eliminating financial barriers to care while saving billions of dollars annually. It's a rare free lunch in economic policy because savings under a single-payer system far outstrip the cost of expanding coverage. The U.S. spends nearly a third of all healthcare dollars on administration, approximately $800 billion annually, primarily coming in the form of private health insurance company overhead and profits. Medicare's fee-for-service plan, in contrast, has 2.4% overhead. Medicare for All could address racial disparities in monkeypox access by making all services free of charge, disproportionately benefiting racial and ethnic minorities. Most Americans would see their income rise, not only because premiums and copayments would fall to near zero, but because for the majority of Americans with employer-sponsored insurance, the potential salary that is currently tied up in insurance subsidies would be freed up. Taken together, these financial boons could disproportionately benefit people of color who are more likely to delay health care because of cost. It's notable that in the Veterans Health Administration, a single-payer healthcare system, many racial disparities in health outcomes are mitigated or absent. When diseases like monkeypox disproportionately affect communities of color, the financial impact on hospital system is not equal, reproducing a structural racism. In general, hospitals primarily serving patients of color earn fewer profits, since these patients are disproportionately uninsured or covered by public insurance, which reimburses less than private insurance. This codifies a perverse financial system in which white lives are more valued than the lives of people of color.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. We're welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. And Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Today we want to talk about an outstanding religious character who is buried in Iran, in Shahr Rey, a suburban part of Iran. Of course, nowadays, Shahr Rey is not considered the capital of Iran, but once in the history, it was one of the greatest cities in Iran, the capital of Iran, and one of the most outstanding religious centers. And today, the tomb of Abdulazim al-Hassani, we can say, is a source of religious benefit and spiritual experience for so many outstanding pilgrims all across the world of Islam. We want to talk about Hazrat Abdulazim al-Hassani and his struggles for Islam. Sayyid Mohsen, let's start with you. What is the significance of this personality in Islam?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, before I start about the Shah Abdul Azim himself, let me give more details about the Rey city where he is buried.
Very good.
Obviously, you talked about the historical aspect.
Yes.
But if we can go back to the 60th century, where we see Imam Hussein has obviously raised against Yazid, we see that Ibn Ziyad gave the promise of the rulership of Rey to Umar ibn Sa'd.
Oh.
And at that time, obviously, Rey wasn't just this small piece of land over here. It was like Tehran and all the places that it was a capital at that time for the Persian, you can say, state. So basically, it was so important place where we have this personality.
Yes.
About Abdulazim Hassani or Shah Abdulazim Hassani, we have both names here. He's from the descendants of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam, and he used to live at the time of Imam Naqi alayhi salam, which is the 10th Imam.
Okay.
And he was one of the students of Imam and a pious, a God-very person. He was an arif mystic of his time, and he was very close to Imam. That we see that in the history, when the people of Rey, when they go to Imam Hadi alayhi salam and they request him, to come to Ray, he sent Shah Abdul Azim Hassani as a representative.
Okay.
So when we want to look at a person, if he is going as a representative of an infallible imam, obviously we should consider that he is at a higher ranks.
That's
and
right.
Obviously he had a high status in the eyes of an infallible imam.
And it was not only Imam Imam al-Naghi, other imams,
yes,
we can say he experienced, but specifically what were his struggles? They believe that he was a brave representative of at least three or four imams, isn't it? At early Islam, and we know that on that time, we can say the atrocity against the Ahlul Bayt and the teachings was at the highest level, but such a brave man stood against them. Let's talk a little bit more about this aspect of the personality of Hazrat Abdul Azim al-Hassani.
Yes, of course, as you rightly mentioned, due to the very severe kind of situation for the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wassalam, when it comes to Abdul Azim al-Hassani alayhi salam, we see that his role in the history of the Shayyo, in the history of the true Islam, is very great, is very important. Because first of all, he himself was such a great figure and personality in the history of Islam that imams like Imam Hadi alayhi salatu wassalam and also Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salatu wassalam, sometimes they were telling the people to go and refer to Abdul Azim al-Hassani and test and examine your beliefs, that whether you have true beliefs, your Islam is the true Islam or not. Because once it is said that Abdul Azim al-Hassani, once he presented his own beliefs, Islamic beliefs, to Imam Hadi alayhi salatu wasalam,
that's right,
in order to make sure himself, to reassure himself that his beliefs are true and he is a true Muslim and true mu'min.
Yes.
And Imam Hadi alayhi salatu wasalam admitted all the beliefs that he presented to the Imam. After that, we see that Imam alayhi salatu wasalam, particularly Imam Hadi alayhi salatu wasalam, was telling the people that if you want to be, make sure yourself that whether you are a true Muslim or not, you have to go to Imam, to Abdul Azim al-Hassani,
yes,
and present your beliefs to this figure, to this person, and then if he admitted, we would admit.
Oh.
So such a great personality he had. Then when he came to Ray, so of course in Qom and Ray and Kashan and many other provinces around this place, there were Shia Muslims living. So that's why we say that the role of Abdul Azim al-Hassani is this, that he spread it.
Yes.
The teachings of the Shayyo, the teachings of Ahlul Bayt in this area. And later in the coming centuries, we see that the Sultanate or Caliphate of Ali Buya we have in this area.
Yes.
So, of course, I think the role of such figures like Abdul Azim al-Hassani,
yes,
is very much great, is very much important.
That's right.
Because they paved the ground for the establishment of that Shia system or Shia government like Ali Buya in this area.
Especially a person like him who was authentic, and we can say experienced living with four imams. I think his ahadith or his narrations that were narrated by Abdul Azim al-Hassani can also be regarded as very much authentic, isn't it, Sayyid Mohsen?
Yes, it is true. Obviously, when he has seen the time of Imam Musa al-Kadhim and then Imam Radha, and then Imam Taqi and then,
yes,
Imam Naqi.
Yes.
So basically, his life is full of, we can say, knowledge and the lightness of the A'imma and the Vilayat. We have, for example, like it is said, from him we have almost 179 narrations which he narrated from three imams.
Okay.
Like Imam Ali Radha alayhi salam, Imam Taqi and then Imam Naqi alayhi salam.
Okay.
So when...
All of them authentic?
Yes, all
of
them.
Chain of narrations, okay.
Authentic.
Good.
And obviously he himself is connected to Imam Hassan. Such a personality, especially at that time, when we see that someone being a representative of Imam coming to the place,
yes,
obviously he is not an ordinary person. The way when we talk in the history about Aban bin Taghlab or, I don't know, Zurara and all,
yes,
those students of Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salam, similarly, someone who is from the descendants of the Prophet and someone who becomes the representative of Imam, someone who is narrating so many ahadith from three imams, obviously he is at a high status. On the other hand, when we look at the history, we see like for the sons of Imam, infallible.
Okay.
Like those who are fallible,
yes,
we would consider being fallible, not infallible. About them, when we talk about the, like in Persian, like they say, Imam Zadegan, for example. The descendants of the Aimah. If we want to know, like, do we need to visit them or not? Obviously, in Iran, there are many of them.
Many of them.
Even in the Qom, like when you go there, everywhere you find the shrines of the descendants of the Aimas. But the point is, do we have any narration or the saying of an infallible imam about them? We find four or five people, four or five descendants about whom it is emphasized to go and visit them. For example, about Hazrat Abbas, he was in Karbala. Hazrat Zainab, she was in Karbala. So these two are clear for us.
Hazrat Masuma.
Other than that, we have Hazrat Masuma.
Yes.
She's in Qom.
Yes.
That whoever visits her, there is a paradise for him.
Yes.
From Imam Taqi. Other than Hazrat Masuma, we have Shah Abdul Azim Hassani.
Yes.
He's here. Shah Chiragh
in Shiraz.
He's in Shiraz. And in Mashhad Ardahal, again, we have an Imam Zanda Sultan.
Yes.
Sayyid Ali Sultan Ali. So these are the four or five people who were at the times of infallibles, and they have emphasized, and they said, for example, for Shah Abdul Azim, they said, like, who visits him, he's just like he's visiting our forefather, Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Yes.
So this also shows the importance of them. And yet, obviously, it is because their personality was in a way that when we say that they have seen the four imams, they have become the representative of imam. So it is because of the character that they have. They have followed the imam as a role model, and they try to be someone like them. So this is the main idea, actually, in Islam, that when we make infallible imams as a role model, we need to become someone like them. So our actions, our deeds, everything should be according to their will.
That's all right. Beside them, Sayyid Jalaluddin Ashraf, you know, the son of Imam Musa al-Kazim, is buried in Astana Ashrafiyya, you know, in Gilan province. It is also one of the greatest, we can say, visiting tomb. And so many other descendants, as you said. Even nowadays, in my neighborhood, you know, around Muallam Square in the holy city of Qom, I see so many pilgrims coming from different countries. For example, from Pakistan, especially going, for example, to Shah Ahmad Qasim, or here and there, okay, Shah Sayyid Ali.
But our discussion was like, do we have the sayings of infallible imams, the concerns of them, or maybe emphasize that visit them, because when you visit them, there is a thawab reward of, for example, like the ziyarat of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, or something that.
Okay.
So there were only four or five people we find.
That's right.
Okay. And amongst them, one Shah is the Shah Abdul Azim Hassan.
Yes, that's right. And this Shah, we say here, is very much different from the king. This means the great saint or holy man.
This is basically in the past, even in Pakistan now.
Yes.
The Sayyids are known as Shah, and they call them Shahji.
Yes.
Ji is like as a respect.
Oh.
And Shah is, and he's from the Sadat. He's just master, like kings. Yes, master. Sayyid,
yes.
So even in Pakistan, we have the grandson of Shah Abdul Azim Hassani, Shah Abdullah Ghazi. He's in Karachi.
Oh.
And he's the, we can say, like, grandson of him. He was the grandfather, like Shah Abdul Azim is grandfather of Shah Abdullah Ghazi. Even with his name, we have this word Shah. It's because of the time at that time. They were not calling the kings only Shah. It was about the Sadat or Sayyids.
Very good.
From the descendants of the Prophet. So in respect, they used to call them Shah rather than taking their name.
That's all right. Okay. What other information can you give us about his life, especially about his scholar life, Sheikh? We got about 2-3 minutes.
Yes, I think first of all, Abdul Azim Al Hassani, we should know that he was a great scholar. You know,
yes.
We have some, for example, descendants of the Ahl al Bayt who were buried here and there, but the role of some of them are very much significant or very much important, particularly when it comes to this point that the situation for the Ahl al Bayt themselves, for the Imams, for Imam Hadi, Imam Hassan al Askari, Imam Jawad. At that time, the situation was so much severe and very much difficult for them to spread the teachings of Islam. They were controlled. So that is why when the people like Abdul Azim al-Hassani and the other great companions of the Ahlul Bayt, they played a very great role in the spreading the teachings of Islam, the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam.
That's right.
The other important point is that their tombs, their holy shrines in the different cities,
yes,
gives the people a very great kind of spirituality, Islamic mm-hmm. spirituality.
Yes.
And this is very much important, that yes, when you go to the to visit the holy shrines of these companions of the Ahlul Bayt, it provides you with a kind of spirituality that affirms, that strengthens your beliefs, your Islam, your, let's say, faith.
That's right.
So I think this is very much important in the history of Islam, because even after their death, their tomb, their holy shrine is like a center in which the teachings of Ahlul Bayt is being spread.
That's
so
right.
I think this is also one of the very significant good role of Imam Abdulazim al-Hassani in that's the history right of Islam.
For our dear listeners in English language who want to be more familiar with Hazrat Abdulazim al-Hassani, the late Azizullah Attaridi, the great, one of the greatest researchers of contemporary Iran, who has so many musnads regarding the life of the infallibles, has a beautiful book, Musnad Hazrat Abdulazim al-Hassani. They can refer to that. Also, Jame Akhbar al-Abdulazim, you know, al-Abdulazim al-Hassani, written by Sheikh al-Saduq, regarding the narrations. There is also a TV miniserial called The Passenger of Ray, which is really beautiful, also subtitled in English language, the full story of Hazrat Abdulazim al-Hassani from Samarra to Ray, in Farsi, Musafir-e-Ray, which is really a beautiful historical miniserial. They can refer to that. And it is, again, according to the authentic resources directed by Davud Mirbagheri, one of the greatest directors of the Council religious movies and ministerials in Iran. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration. And Sayyid Mohsen, it was very kind of you talking about the personality of Hazrat Abdulazim al-Hassani. And thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers, sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatihi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the program For Humanity. We were talking about greed in the previous episode and how it has the power to destroy mankind, and how those who are greedy overtake the rights of other people. And the example we gave, first example we gave in this regard, is wealth. When people or systems or countries become so greedy, they go and they take the rights of other people and deprive them of their resources. So we gave the example of Africa when it comes to gold. When it comes to certain countries who, for example, have oil, some Western countries, they come to these countries and they start pumping oil from their lands and giving it to themselves, either for free or almost free, while the people of that country have to suffer. That's a form of a greed. Also, when a person, for example, becomes so in love and attached to the throne, aka position, power, authority, president, vice president, parliament member, statesman, and so on and so forth. These people, when they sit in these chairs, greed comes hard. And if a person is not God-fearing, then obviously he will fall victim to that trap of greed, and under the name or pretext of authority and power. So this is also something that we have to be aware of. So one day I can be a boss or a manager or president of a place, and if I get greedy, then I will take the right of other people. And Amir al-Mu'min Ali alayhi salam, when he was finally, people decided to come to him and say, okay, you know what, we have no one else, how about you come take control? He says, no, I'm not interested. I don't want power. I don't seek power like those before me. Other kings and what have you before Amir al-Mu'mineen and after Amir al-Mu'mineen, they were greedy. And that's why they wanted power, because they wanted to accumulate wealth. Some of them, when they died, they had to break gold in axes because they got too greedy. While millions of Muslims had to suffer hunger and pain because they were poor. Amir al-Mu'mineen said, I don't want to do that. I am not after power. If you want me to take position, then you have to accept the fact that I will rule by what Allah deems to be correct and what Allah wants. And that's something obviously most of the greedy people did not like. Anyway, our topic is not Amir al-Mu'mineen here. But the idea is position can drive people to greed. So why do people get greedy? What is the secret that makes people get greedy? So we said that human beings love perfection. They want to be perfect. And when I see my perfection lies in wealth, and I see my perfection lies in position and power, I want to see my wealth or my perfection lies in having so much wealth that I can buy houses and cars and what have you, then halal and haram will fly out the door, because all I care about now is myself, is my perfection. How can I get so much money so I can feel complete? That's the problem. Now, Before we continue, let us take a short break and then we can come back.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. So we were saying that greed, and when people see their perfection in greed, that's when they will take the rights of other people. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala interestingly says in the Quran, إِنَّ الْإِنسَانَ خُلِقَ هَلُوعًا. Mankind was created in a state of being extremely greedy and lack of patience. What a combination. We have lack of patience, we want to be rich very quickly, and we are greedy. So instead of me having to work and earn my money, I say, well, how about if I take it from someone else? Even if it's not ethical, even if it's not moral, but yeah, it gives me my perfection. Therefore, you see many people get rich on the expenses of the poor and on the expenses of other people. Even if they have to steal from them, even if they have to take it. And then, obviously, they will justify it. That's what greedy people do. They justify their actions. So we have this hastiness. We're always in a hurry. And, obviously, we want to have as much as we can from this dunya, which is a problem. So we look at this dunya, we look at this world, as the goal of creation. The more you have, the happier you are. And that's the fallacy, and that's the illusion that shaitan puts in the hearts and in the minds of people to take them away from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, when he looks at this concept of hirs, this concept of greed, he says, in dunya mujghalatan an ghayriha, this world, if you try to spend your time in it, it will occupy your mind and make you busy from the real thing. And then he says, وَمَنْ لَمْ يَصِبْ صَاحِبُهَا مِنْهَا شَيْءٍ إِلَّا فَتَحَ لَهُ حُرْصٌ عَلَيْهَا. That every time a person who's occupied in this dunya, once he moves towards it, this dunya will open another door for him. So basically, it just keeps him more busy, more busy. And until he reaches a stage where, obviously, he will wake up one day and he finds himself in the hereafter and he finds the angel of death, and then it will be too late. But what concerns us is that when we become so attached to this world and want to have money and wealth, then obviously we will fall in the trap of oppressing other people, taking the rights of other people. Look at any war that happens in the world. Why does it happen? Why do wars happen? Isn't it because, at least let's say, the main causes, is it because this country wants to have the land of another country? Or they want to have the resources of another country, be it oil, be it gas, and sometimes even water, for example. They go and invade because they want to have it to themselves. And that's one of the causes that people go to war. They go to war for spoils and for victory, to get more of this dunya. But then the ones who suffer, the ones who end up paying the price, are the normal people. People get to suffer and get to live in poverty and get to feel the harshness of this life. And they're not meant to, mind you. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants people to live happily, to enjoy the beauties of this life. But because there are greedy people in this world and greedy systems in this world, they deprive others. And this is where injustice and oppression occurs. Greed is a deadly sin. Me and you, we have to also be aware that it does not come to us and we do not become greedy.
Inshallah, we will continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
On the last day of September, Burkina Faso military leader President Paul Henri Damiba was deposed in the country's second coup in a year as Army Captain Ibrahim Traore took charge of the restive West African nation. Now, the coup was welcomed by many in the streets of the country's capital, Ouagadougou.
We are in the streets not because we support a coup or encourage it, but to find unity and truth. We are here to support our military, to find peace, because we have suffered so much at the hands of terrorists.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the recent coup in Burkina Faso, which came amid an upsurge of terrorist attacks. The people of Burkina Faso, just like many in neighboring West African countries, believe that former colonial power France is responsible for the current insecurity across the region. Our expert will be giving us her take on the reasons for the coup in Burkina Faso. The second part of our program today will be on condescending remarks by the United States climate envoy John Kerry, who is demanding that African countries should not invest in long-term gas projects.
The struggle in Burkina Faso. Burkina Faso Army Captain Ibrahim Traoré has ousted military leader Lieutenant Colonel Paul Henri Damiba in what marks the second coup in the West African country this year. According to a statement read on national TV on 30th of September, Traoré and a group of officers deposed Damiba, dissolved the government, and suspended the constitution and transitional charter.
Traoré said the officers who helped Damiba seize power in January had decided to remove their leader due to his inability to deal with insurgent groups, including some associated with Al-Qaeda and Daesh. A Burkina Faso military spokesman is seen here making the coup announcement.
Our common ideal was betrayed by our leader, Lieutenant Colonel Paul Henri Damiba, in whom we had placed all our trust. Indeed, the deterioration of the security situation, which justified our action, has been relegated to the background in favor of unfortunate political adventures.
Well, to discuss the recent military coup in Burkina Faso, we contacted Ms. Inem Richardson. She's an organizer with All African People's Revolutionary Party. She's also the co-founder of the Thomas Sankara Center for African Liberation and Unity. Thanks a lot, madam, for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm always happy to be on.
Now, what really led to the latest coup in Burkina Faso just months after another military takeover?
Well, I think if we look at the context behind this coup and the last one, we see that the original coup against Damiba was actually quite popular at first. People came out largely in support of it because the hope was that Damiba would follow the direction that Mali took and divorce Burkina Faso from France and French domination, as well as from Western control in general. That was very much the desire of the people on the ground and why people wanted coup in the first place. After a long period of time, people began to see that there was not much of a difference in terms of how France's relationship with Burkina Faso materialized or existed on the ground, as well as how the Damiba administration was approaching the security situation in the Sahel region and the border region with Mali. So there was an increased over time discontent with Damiba.
The dramatic takeover, which ended with ousted military leader fleeing to neighboring Togo, coincided with violent anti-French protests and the sudden emergence of Russian flags among demonstrators. The army officers who seized power in Burkina Faso say toppled military leader Paul Henri